Okay. Well, welcome everybody to March's edition of Appreciators. Bit of housekeeping first. I think, Henry, if you've got everyone who's going to sign up on the
everybody
email list.
Who wants to be on?
Who wants to be on it?
Everybody doesn't want to be on.
Okay, great. If you're on the mailing list, you'll get Henry's recording, audio recording. We agreed, for the use of this area, we agreed to spend 80 pesos each, which isn't hard with a bit of a drink and a snack, or you can stay for dinner. Any other, any other housekeeping at this point? Yeah, we're all okay. Well, today we have we're Sandy, who's going to give us a talk on how to think positively. About positive thinking. But before that, I wanted to apologize for last month's meeting. It wasn't what it should have been. And
they were not there.
And I was in contact with the gentleman, Charles, since November, telling him that we didn't really want the presentation of the 9/11 truth movement, nor that we wanted a discussion of the two, but how, for seemingly similar evidence, we came up with such different conclusions, and how we validated those conclusions. And perhaps I'd like to hope it goes until the next year, because I was hoping to learn something other than the mystery hologram projector. I was hoping to learn something useful about my own beliefs. And it didn't happen. I think it just evolved into a series of statements of which I didn't know how to process them. I didn't know how to understand the plausibility of what he was saying. And I still don't know. I still don't know when you've got an event as big as 9/11, you cannot reproduce. How do you fit through your biases, is what he said true? I was asking myself. And I was wondering how I would ever come to the conclusion that he was or he wasn't. So I'm going to hold that all for the next month. I'll put some things together about how we arrive at truth and belief without the ability to have some sort of empirical system to have the evidence and have the reproducible experiment would lead us to say, yeah, that's sufficient for me. I don't really know what is sufficient for me. I'm still trying to figure it out. Yeah.
Well, can I make one comment?
Yeah.
Now that it's going to get worse. Because now the computer imaging and that is so good that we can make videos of anything we want.
Yeah.
And it used to be, at least video evidence was pretty good, but you can now paste in things, basically in video, still photographs. You can paste in pretty much anything you want. So you can't even really believe video evidence.
So where do we, now, I mean, that's part of the question, is where do we go?
Yeah, it's really bad.
You know,
it's going to get worse.
It's probably, and I don't know how it will get better. I mean, I'm struggling.
Yeah. Good.
And I would appreciate, you know,
really bad.
The input of everyone else is to how do I sort all this out?
We have to go by some kind of reputation system.
Maybe. Yes.
Speaking of reputation, one research I really did on that last week is to discover that within the 9/11 truth movement, the hologram movement is a niche group that the rest of the truthers think are giving them a bad name.
Yeah. I mean, there isn't a unified 9/11 truth movement. You know, there are the lasers and the space aliens and there are fringe groups within the fringe group. But how do you during the presentation, he seems to be presenting a lot of things that appear to be scientifically factual. We have a lot of equations and graphs, and it seems to be backed up by people with certain reputations.
Well,
It seemed to be.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure she was, and some, you know, she was a classic
cover for this new debris. Well, I saw a photo of a piece of airline lying on the field by the Pentagon. So there's definitely debris.
Well, if you trust that image.
That's from Trump. I tend to trust that image more than his statement saying there's no debris.
Well, can we get a little bit of the
yeah, sure. I just want to say one thing. I
didn't come because I said to him, one of my classmates, Owen Green, who is an expert on fire, and he was asked afterwards, right after the situation, to come in and investigate Albert Powers. So, and his presentation and his report was amazing. And immediately when I said to him, he said, oh, he was paid off.
So if that's okay, Neville, next month we'll get into it about how we, you know, with an increasingly difficult technological underpinning, how do we arrive at plausible knowledge? Okay? And if that's happy, I'll turn it over to Sandy, who's going to talk about the perils of the
recipe. Okay, so, is that
psychology is so focused on the things that go wrong with people and giving them back to kind of a baseline. But there's nobody starting us with a baseline and trying to make us happier. And so he kind of wanted to do that. And he started studying optimism. And there is a lot of research that suggests that optimism could lead to a longer and maybe more successful life, or at least a happier life. So a lot of people who are not so big on the word optimism have kind of looked at this and said, well, there's some problems with that. First of all, that there's natural optimism, which I know some people who are like that, and then there's learned optimism. And learned optimism is kind of a forced thing. And so the people who live longer, these optimists who live longer, are they natural optimists, or could you actually live longer if you learn to be optimistic? So they don't know that. It's all correlative studies. And, of course, you have to be very careful about correlation versus causation. And so they're suggesting, okay, well, maybe being an optimist gives you a longer, happier life. Well, maybe having a long, happy life makes you an optimist. But if you have lived in a situation where things have tended to go right for you and have worked out well, maybe you're going to tend to be an optimist. And so those two things go together in the opposite direction. And the other thing is that when you think about it, cultivating optimism is really kind of self-contradictory, because if you really believe the world is a positive place, you don't have to work at believing it's a positive place, right? You don't have to be constantly trying to convince yourself of that. Learned optimism, and I read quite a bit on this, because I thought it was interesting, because I learned to be more optimistic, so I'm not a natural optimist. It requires constant self-deception. And that's really something that humans aren't very good at. We're good at unconscious self-deception, but deliberate conscious self-deception we're not very good at. Yeah, you know, another part of it is, okay, no, that's not true. Okay? So, and then with positive thinking and success, yes, positive thinking does seem to be correlated with success, but at what cost? I'll talk about that a little more in the future. And then how do you define success? Okay, so one of the biggest problems with positive thinking is how the concept in the hands of the pop psychologists and self-help gurus has been oversimplified, fluffed up, and turned into an ideology. So, a lot of you probably heard in Norman Vincent Peale and are aware of his book, The Power of Positive Thinking, was published, I think, in the 40s. Yeah, okay, that sounds right. And let me just give you a quote from Norman Vincent Peale's book. Says, the way to happiness, keep your heart free from hate, your mind from worry. Live simply, expect little, give much. Scatter sunshine, forget self, think of others. Try this for a week and you'll be surprised. Okay, that's the 40s. Now, a more recent guru, Brian Tracy, who's a big hero of a lot of businesses, who tries to bring this thinking to their employees. Here's a quote from him. Healthy, happy people think about what they want and how to get it most of the time. In this way, developing a positive attitude can truly change your entire life. Okay, so it's gone from the more you think about others, the happier you'll be, to, you know, the more you think about what you want, how to get it, happier you'll be. And I think that's really great for encouraging the consumer culture in the United States, right? So you don't want anybody to settle down truly satisfied and happy, but I'm always grasping for that next thing. Okay, so what are some of the dark sides of positive thinking? Well, first, there's some psychological side effects. And one of them is just the cost of high expectations of optimism. If you're a natural optimist, this may not be a problem for you, but if you're a learned optimist, then, and you're constantly trying to convince yourself, everything's going to be fine, well, you know, I see little indications of things may not be going well, but I'm going to ignore them. You're going to be deeply disappointed and have no plan B when your plan A fails. So if you're so optimistic that you only have a plan A, then you're going to have a real problem. And I got to say, I don't know how many of the rest of you feel this way, I see that here in paradise. Constantly people talking about they don't want to hear anything negative about it, they don't want to hear, you know, anything negative about Mexico or the crime or anything like that. And then when something happens, now we got here for our very first visit about 2 days after the lawyer was shot and then he pronounced him Rosa. I don't even know how many of you know about that one. That was probably about 7 years ago, 8 years ago now, okay? And the community was in a panic. This guy had been unloading his groceries. A couple of kids came up behind him. What's that?
Chris.
Yeah, I didn't know it. And a couple of kids came up, one with a gun, and said, give us your wallet, and he refused to do it. They got a little tussle, he got shot. And the community was completely in a panic. They just had screened out the whole idea that this could possibly happen. And when it happened, a lot of people left permanently, and it, you know, it just caused this big ripple effect. So to me, it's kind of odd that people think that this is a magic place where the normal problems of life that would happen. But I think that, you know, a lot of people are losing themselves in that. And partly because their neighbors are all saying, up north, they're saying, but anyway. Okay, so that's not quite the same as a true dyed-in-the-wool optimist. I had a friend in Sacramento. This woman was a force of nature. She was Mormon and had several kids and wanted to stay home with them because she found out her daycare worker was drugging them with Tylenol to make them sleep during the day or some cough medicine. And so she decided she would write novels. And she worked for 5 years to get her first one written and finally got it sold, and she has since become a very successful romance author. And she, you know, she's begun to write a book in like 3 weeks or something, and she's, you know, she's cranking out. Well, her husband, meanwhile, is one of these guys who's always following the various pre-plans. And he's always getting into the trouble. He's always borrowing money because he's going to make it all back with his own. And then they owe these people money. And she was actually contemplating divorce as a woman, because she was so afraid, she needed to protect her assets, this money that she worked so hard for, because he was such an optimist that even when things went wrong, he couldn't earn from it. He basically didn't even recognize what had happened and went on to the next thing. So that's the other kind of dark side extreme. Okay, so then the question is, are you happier than an optimist, or could you possibly be happier than a pessimist? And for this, I'm going to read you a quote. I don't know who this guy is. His name is Brian Appleyard, and he has a blog, and this is titled Invasion of the Neo-Optimist, talking about this latest movement of optimism. And he says, they're saying that pessimists cannot be happy. He said, as the happiest and most well-adjusted person I know is devout pessimist, I find this idea ridiculous. My friend delights in life precisely because he expects nothing of it. If he happens among something good or beautiful, then it is a bonus, a miracle. So optimism equals high expectations, and many optimists must live in a state of constant dissatisfaction with the normal problems of life. It's just constant, oh, you know, I can't believe that happened. Okay, the next kind of dark side is the self-esteem movement. Okay, we define self-esteem as positive thinking about yourself. Is it important? Yes. For happiness to be achieved, you have to have a certain level of self-esteem. The problem happened when somebody, and it started in California, I think probably under Jerry Brown's original term, I'm not sure, that he did a study and correlated self-esteem with high achievement. So he thought, wouldn't it be great if we go give all to self-esteem and then they'll all be high achievers? Got it backwards, right? These people have self-esteem because they achieved something, because of the work and the effort that they put into achievement. Okay, so what happened out of that was the big educational movement of self-esteem, where now we can't put red marks on the kids' papers, and we can't give them bad grades, and we can't, and everything is praise, even if it's praiseworthy. And Phil knows how I used to grumble at every soccer interview and all the kids got poofed. I just didn't think it was healthy. So all these kids who had put in no effort and were deserving of the fact to be getting these trophies. And there was a lot of talk about unconditional love. But people were confusing it with unconditional acceptance. You can love somebody unconditionally, but then you might want the best for them and hope to kind of draw out of them what they can accomplish rather than just accept everything they do. And yes, it appears that the self-esteem movement has failed. There's been a lot of follow-up studies on it. I like this quote. I did wrote who said it. It was in an article in Newsweek with my dad. Yes, we have a self-esteem problem in our country, but we don't recognize it because, well, we have a self-esteem problem. In other words, we think so highly of ourselves we can't see that we think a little too highly of ourselves, okay? Okay, so the studies have seemed to indicate that unearned self-esteem leads to narcissism, low motivation, and loyalty. Because, hey, if I'm so great already, you know, why would I want to put all that effort to accomplish anything? Another interesting correlation they found is that most bullies actually test very high for self-esteem. There was a feeling that bullies because of low self-esteem, and they've actually found out they bully because they think they can, you know, they're entitled to it. And obviously not true of all of them, but it tends to be a strong correlation. It also strengthens the Dunning-Kruger effect. If you've heard of that, it's the idea that the most incompetent people are the most likely to overrate their competence because they don't understand what it means to be competent. Okay. So, for instance, when I used to be the technical interviewer at the company and work for new programmers coming in to evaluate their technical skills. And we were looking for people who knew the language Java, and one of the questions I always asked them was, rate yourself on scale 1 to 10. And if I get an 8 or a 9, I knew I was talking to a novice. Because nobody who really knew that language would rate themselves higher than 7. The very best people we hired would have rated themselves a 6 or a 7. Because they understood how huge it was and how little they actually knew of it, whereas the beginners had no idea thought they were pretty hot stuff. And we can even take this all the way to American exceptionalism, right? That this idea that we're number one, even though we aren't, in anything except what is it, most people incarcerated and some other
Most order.
So in the face of evidence to the contrary, you can still hang on to this idea of American exceptionalism. And the other interesting thing is that this kind of unconditional praise backfires people who already have low self-esteem. It does not change their image of themselves. If they've already got the idea that they're kind of a loser, then everything you say to them to try to make them feel differently just rings in their head as false, and they don't trust you anymore, and you can't move on with them. And maybe we've all had that with our moms, Oh, sorry. Well, you're my mom. Of course you say that. You just can't. Okay, so that's the self-esteem movement. Then there's visualization. So you probably all heard this idea that if you want to accomplish something, you visualize yourself having accomplished it, right? I want to be a successful author. I'll visualize myself receiving, prizes or being a New York Times editor or whatever. And this, on the surface, sounds reasonable. You've got a target to shoot for. But the research suggests that when you visualize yourself having accomplished something, your unconscious mind kind of registers that as, okay, you've done it. Like, you don't have to do it anymore. You've done it. You've gotten there. Okay, so it actually seems to lower motivation to accomplish the thing that you're visualizing. You're high, okay, you're there, especially if you're really, really good at visualizing. And the other thing is that it encourages you to focus on what you don't have, that you want to have. So you're always thinking about what you don't have. And that leads to, somebody called that deficit living. I thought that was a good way to put it. Leading to constant dissatisfaction, despite the fact that you're trying to be positive. And that brings me to the pinnacle of visualizing, which is the law of attraction. You probably all heard of it, right? The secret and this idea that you can manifest things in your life by visualizing. Alright? So while it used to be the American dream of work hard and you can achieve anything, which never really was true, you can achieve something, you can't achieve anything necessarily. The positive thinking dream, American dream, is think hard and you can achieve anything. So by doing that, it actually reduces action and effort. People are sitting around in front of their visualization board instead of actually going out and trying to accomplish the things they want to have. Okay, it might lead to a sense of entitlement, the idea that the universe wants you to have this. One of the authors was saying her friend showed up with a new purse and she manifested it. And the other one said, how civil are my American Express cards? Okay? And when it doesn't work, people blame themselves. Okay? So I can't look up. What does that happen when people try visualizing, manifesting, and it doesn't work? And they all think they didn't do it right. They don't think, well, this is really a false thing. It doesn't really work that way. I didn't do it right. And that leads to the extreme blaming people for their own diseases. Now, there's a book by a woman called Barbara Ehrenreich. It's called Bright-Sighted. And she got into this whole thing when she was diagnosed with breast cancer and became involved in the support system thing. They discovered she was not allowed to say anything negative. She wasn't allowed to say, I'm angry and sad. Then everybody would jump on her and say, oh, you need to go to a therapist right away. You because why? Because that could make your disease worse. Your tumor will grow faster if you're sitting around making these things. Okay, so he talks about Deepak Chopra is a big fan of thinking your way well, right? And so she was talking about something she read this, where this woman was saying, I'm doing my best to use positive thinking, but the tumor is metastasizing, it keeps coming back. What am I doing wrong? You're totally responding. As far as I can tell, you are doing all the right things to recover. You just have to continue doing them until the cancer is gone for good. I know it is discouraging to make great progress only to have it come back again, but sometimes the cancer is simply very pernicious and requires the utmost diligence and persistence to eventually overcome it. So here she is. What's your fault? I'm sorry to say it, but it's your fault. Okay, Barbara, the writer, was on to with this quote. Even more distressing was the person who said, I know I have to be positive all the time. That is the only way to cope with cancer, but it's so hard to do. I know that if I get sad or scared or upset, I am making my tumor grow faster and I will shorten my life. I find that's heartbreaking to me, that quote, okay? So Barbara concludes, clearly the failure to think positively can weigh on a cancer patient like a second disease. So here is this woman, find desperately to crucify her lady to spot when she can't do it, she's sure she's hastening her own death. Okay? The other side of this manifesting is if only one team can win and you're the winner, who's the loser? So you have to, you know, the football game for both sides are praying to win. But only one can win, then what happens? Did God not like the other side? What's going on here? Okay, so this is taken to an extreme. People who talk about the law of attraction, the gurus for the law of attraction, basically talk about avoiding anything negative in your life because that will bring negative things to you. Okay, so this guy named Wallace Wow, he's one of the founders of this whole law of attraction idea, wrote, do not talk about poverty, do not investigate it or concern yourself with it. Do not spend your time in charitable work or charity movements. All charity only stands for perpetuating the recognition and to eradicate. Give your attention wholly to riches, ignore poverty. And so basically you're saying, you know, if people around you have a problem, run the other way. But it's a manifest itself in your life. Okay? The woman who loves the secret takes this a step further. If you see people who are overweight, do not observe them. If you think or talk about diseases, you will become sick. What you think or surround yourself with, good or bad, is what you will bring upon yourself. So thank goodness those people in medical profession are not buying into that. You know, we all do this, that would be kind of a sad world. Okay? So that's the law of attraction. And then there's affirmation. So we all know, like, the Stuart Smiley, the Al Franken gold character on SNL. I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and all the right people like me or something. Look in here every day, besides this. And so once again, when they studied this, they found it works great for people who already have high self-esteem, but it doesn't work at all for people at low self-esteem, or it can even make you feel worse. Because they can immediately see the gap between what they're telling themselves and what they're really feeling about themselves. And it just brings them down further. And eventually, this kind of thing might lead to this desire to have a certain positive experience, and everybody's telling you we need to, maybe the self-medicating. So, my first mother-in-law, for instance, was bipolar. I think this is pretty common with bipolar people. When they're in the manic phase of the disease, they don't want medication because it feels so good. It feels mighty, you know, and they do all sorts of dangerous things. I mean, she was inviting strangers into her house. She was walking around 1 or 3 a.m. in dangerous parts of the city because she thought she was invincible and didn't want to take any of the medication for it. And then there's the other way around, like methamphetamine, which leads to the Superman syndrome that I can do anything, and that leads to that addiction because that's such a good feeling. It's like not being comfortable with your negative side and always having kind of positive side to me and things like that. And then there's the effect of pushing away the negative thoughts, something that the philosopher Alan Watts called the backward rule. And basically, it's that the more you think about what you want but don't have it, the more you think about the shortcomings in your life. Okay, so there's a book called The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F-Star-T-K. I don't know how many of you have seen that, it's a New York Times bestseller. He says, the desire for a more positive experience is itself a negative experience, and paradoxically, the acceptance of one's negative experience is itself a positive experience. So he's basically saying, the more you're thinking about that you should be positive, but you're not, that feels negative, the more you can accept that negative things will happen, that becomes, you know, a positive. And then they're stressing over stress. Some recent studies have suggested, and I have no idea, you know, how accurate this is, but they did studies on people, the effect of stress on the health, and they found that it negatively impacted the health most of people who thought that stress had a negative impact on their health. Okay, so basically, if you weren't really worried about it, you considered it kind of just this nice motivational driving force, it had much less negative impact on health. But once again, just a correlated study, that if you were really worried about the fact that you were always stressed. Okay, so those are some psychological effects and some real life side effects. First one being the failing or refusing to see any danger. So one survey was done with drivers, asking them did they think they were below average or above average drivers. And a significant percentage rated themselves as above average drivers. The irony of this was that this survey group was deliberately pulled from the people who had a most accident that had been reported in the DFC. And they, you know, they rated themselves like they were, you know, like 79% on a scale, you know, how good drivers they were. So you can see that because they think they're such great drivers, they're out on the road, you know, and everybody else is probably driving extensively against them, they're getting an accident, and they're never going to accept that. The next thing is irrational exuberance. So my friend's husband was a good example of irrational exuberance, this unbridled and unjustified optimism. It's turning a blind eye to an inconvenient truth. Okay? So even some people I know who believe in climate change say, I'm not worried about it because I know this technology is going to come up enough. You know? So, and it's very possible that technology is going to take us a long way towards dealing with the problem, but they don't want to deal with it in any way that would make them have to sacrifice anything or anything like that. This irrational exuberance is what's behind all bubbles, okay, including the one that caused the Great Recession in the United States. And I remember at the time thinking, how can they be lending all these money to people who won't be able to pay it back? But all these people were in a bubble, they were in a, you know, a psychological bubble with all the other people who were saying, real estate always goes up, and, you know, there's no reason we can't grow forever, and you know, there were literally people at some of these organizations, these financial organizations, who were getting demoted or fired while coming forward and saying, but wait a minute, you know, this is not right, we have to do something because they were essentially making suggestions to the business, and the business didn't want it here. And just the whole myth of perpetual growth, you know, it always puzzles me how we think that our economy continues to grow every year ad infinitum because, if, you know, at some point we're going to run out of the things we need to grow. So then there's, this is a paper that was written in a scientific journal called Goals Gone Wild. Okay? So the idea of goal setting. And how does goal setting relate to positive thinking? Well, used properly, it's not. If you set reasonable goals for yourself and try to achieve them, that's a reasonable thing. It becomes irrational positive thinking when you keep thinking you can be a goal by downing evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
All right, so there was a study called the Yale Goal Study, and I can't remember when the year this was done. I think in the 50s. And so they surveyed the people at Yale to find out if they had life goals. And then they went back 20 years later and found out that the 3% of them that had, had solid goals and planned to reach them had accumulated as much wealth as the other 97% combined. Like, well, how can we ignore that? So the guy who published his results, moved into it, and he discovered that there's no evidence that that study was ever done. That those results ever came out. And it's one of those things, kind of like you need to drink 8 glasses of water a day, that when they try to find out who originally said that, they're all pointing at each other. So all of the positive thinking gurus were saying, well, you know, go talk to Brian Tracy, go talk to, you know, all the big names, Napoleon Hill or whatever, and they all said, well, I heard from somebody else, And when they went to Yale, there was no evidence, because they disclosed it and done through the alumni organization, no evidence that it had ever been done. There was just one of those things that sounded good, that people kept saying, there's probably a lot of stuff like there, like that out there. Okay, so goal setting in business, and some of you may have had this experience. You're required to be in here to set your goals, and as the year goes on and you're realizing that they weren't the right goals to begin with, or that you're not going to achieve them for one reason or another, you actually can't go to your boss and tell them. They don't want to hear it. That's the goal, and I need to achieve it. And I found this in information technology. In information technology, a very high percentage of project sales, and I can't remember what it is, but it's in the 50% range or maybe even a little bit more. They fail. Okay, and the project sales, the plan sales, and everybody wants to figure out why that's happening. And it's like being in the middle of it, I know why it's happening. The plan was never right to begin with. You cannot plan something that complicated. Every IT project is an engineering project. It's not a manufacturing project. You're not redoing the same steps of making something that that other people know how to do, like building a bridge. It's an engineering project, you that there's done before, you don't know what they're running into, and yet your company makes you come up with a plan, and if you can't meet the plan, they don't want to hear it. And then the project fails, and it goes all wrong. Because it was impossible to begin with. And there was a counter movement, and I guess it's this called agile development in information technology, where you just say, I'm going to have a kind of big picture while I'm still very vague, and I'm just going to set my first goal. The first thing I want to deliver. And I'm going to deliver it, and I'm going to let people start using it, and I'm going to see how it goes. Because a lot of times people ask me, they didn't really, they have these visions that aren't really realistic. And then I'll adjust, and then, we'll go on to step two. And I proposed this to the commander group before, and everything sounded great, and off we went, and I submitted the first round, and they said, well, where's the whole plan? They just could not hold it. They had to have the 100% plan with all the deliverables. Okay, so then it's obviously manipulation, where companies use it to get more out of employees without paying them. So companies really are the main supporter of this right now.
Yes.
They're the ones who pay the big bucks for the seminars and buying the 10,000 copies of books we got from Folks Got Free Books while we were working for, all of these new ideas. So I don't know how many of you have ever worked somewhere that had like inspirational posters on the wall. I don't know if anybody has seen the sarcastic inspirational posters, like the one motivation, and it has different sentences. It's a pretty poster and it keeps saying all it takes to motivate you, you probably have a very easy job. Or teamwork, this is my favorite. Ensuring that your hard work will probably be ruined by someone else's incompetence. Okay, but people put these real posters, and these employers genuinely think that this is going to work to motivate people. And sometimes it does work. So their goal is always kind of subversive. It's not to make you happier, it's employees to get more out of you. So they're all behind it. Okay, so I just wanted to go down a quick list of alternatives to positive thinking that can help. I don't want to believe that you're saying please don't think positively because it doesn't work. What are some alternatives to positive thinking that maybe will take you down a road to more happiness or more success or whatever it is you're looking for? And the first one is what's commonly called gratitude, but I like to call it appreciation. Okay? So it is kind of every cloud is a silver lining, but it's not necessarily that you look at the negative and try to find a positive in it, but do you recognize the positive when it does happen? Because we are hardwired to always see the negative and always see the negative, and you kind of have to think about recognizing positive when it happens. So this is a quote from Kurt Vonnegut, he's probably my favorite author, and he wrote a lot of essays about life, and he's writing about his uncle Alex. And he said, one of the things Uncle Alex found objectionable about human beings was that they so rarely noticed it when they were happy. He himself did his best to acknowledge it when times were sweet. We could be drinking lemonade in the shade of an apple tree in the summertime, and Uncle Alex would interrupt the conversation to say, if this isn't nice, what is? So I hope that you will do the same for the rest of your life. And this is a commencement address. when things are going sweetly and peacefully, please pause a moment and then say out loud, if this isn't nice, what is? So that's not a matter of trying to, like, shove your negative thoughts over the positive side myself. We're just realizing that there are a lot of good things that happen and not just letting them slide by. Okay, the next one, Buddhism or mindfulness, is obviously having a big crest of popularity, and there are some interpretations of it that think it's like trying to push away your negative emotions, but actually, in true Buddhism, there's an acceptance of negative emotions. Okay, you accept that they exist, you look at them, you just kind of let them happen, you try not to attach to them and let them carry you away, but you don't try to push them away. And the other part of Buddhism is equanimity, which is striving for equanimity, which is not like a strong reaction to the things that happen. And a lot of people think that this would lead to complacency or indifference, but it's not that. It's the idea that, yes, there are things you're going to want to change, but if you go into it with this, hot, with all these negative emotions, you're actually going to have a much harder time accomplishing what you want than getting focused on it. And you were saying something about that earlier. I can't remember exactly what you were saying just now, letting yourself calm down and be rational and then go pursue it. You don't have to accept everything in the world. You have to accept that it is where it is right now. How can I improve it and not be letting negative emotions describe that? Okay, then there's been a lot of studying in something called defensive pessimism. That's how I would describe myself. I'm a defensive pessimist. A defensive pessimist, when something is coming up that scares them, thinks about all the things that could go wrong. Literally, tries to make a mental list of everything that could go wrong, and what will I do if that happens? And what will I do if that happens? Like if there was layoffs hitting in our company, and I didn't know how I was going to do one of them, it was like, okay, if I lose my job, what will I do? And if I can't find another job, what will I do? You kind of talk your way through it so that you feel prepared. That when you go in there and they say, if I turn out I wasn't one of them, but you go in there and say you will one of them, if you are, you have a way to cope with it. Okay? So that's a lot of concentrating on negative to try to be more positive. Cognitive behavior therapy. Strangely, some of the founders of cognitive behavior therapy also drove some of the positive movement, but in cognitive behavior therapy, they try to say thought is not positive or negative. In other words, don't worry about whether it's positive or negative. Worry about whether it's helpful or not. Because you're going to have some negative thoughts that are very helpful. What's that pain? Should I go to a doctor? And rather than pushing away the fact that you have the pain, you acknowledge that it's there and try to decide, what we should do about it. So that's one thing where you're looking at negative emotions, you look at what we consider negative, like having pain, and saying, okay, what should I do about it? And then acknowledging the positive aspects of negative experience, in other words, acknowledging the failure of the learning experience, the errors can teach you a lot, that effort is good. Why do we do puzzles and play bridge and all that? It's because we really like having a problem or an obstacle that we've got to solve. In one meeting we talked about being able to take a pill and know how to speak Spanish or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a situation where you're in an after and you're going, oh, you need to like Spanish, that's great. But in my mind I was thinking, but the effort of learning how to speak it has been for me one of the biggest joys in coming out the other side with being able to speak it. Because I made the effort. Another thing is resilience or grit, which is getting a lot of attention right now, and that's basically developing your skill at recovering from setbacks. So rather than convince yourself that that's ever going to happen, it's working on your skill at recovering from setbacks. And then, so I'm going to end up with a quote from the Bright Side book. Says the truly self-confident, or those who have in some way made their peace with the world and their destiny within it, do not need to expend effort censoring or otherwise controlling their thoughts. Positive thinking may be a quintessentially American activity associated in our minds with both individual and national success, but it is driven by a terrible insecurity. Americans did not start out with positive thinkers. At least the promotion of unwarranted optimism and methods to achieve it did not really find articulation and organized form until several decades after the founding of the Republic. In the Declaration of Independence, the founding fathers pledged to one another, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. they knew they had no certainty of winning a war for independence and that they were taking a moral risk. This act of signing the declaration made them all traitors to the crown, and treason was a crime punishable by execution. Many of them did want to lose their lives, loved ones, and fortunes in the war. The point is, they fought anyway. There's a vast difference between positive thinking and existential courage.
I'll let you manage the questions.
Secular humanists, as defined by the Council for Secular Humanism, because positive psychology values religion and spirituality. And spirituality is specifically rejected by the Council for Secular Humanism as being transcendental, and therefore outside of science, outside of physical reality. Finally, I would offer that we have an outstanding example of positive thinking right now in the occupant of the White House.
Magical.
Yeah. He is said to have admired Norman Vincent Peale very much.
Mm-hmm.
And when Norman Vincent Peale came out with his book, The Power of Positive Thinking, and he showed this illusionary view of reality, what we call the solipsistic view of reality, in which the view of reality is that which satisfies one's own needs. I think most people realize that he's a narcissist, that everything revolves around him. That explains why his inauguration crowd was the largest in history, while his win in the Electoral College was the greatest in history, while he's accomplished more in the first year of his presidency than any other president in history, while why he's the greatest president in history, maybe after Abraham. So I think there are many negative things to be said about positive thinking and about positive psychology. A book that I haven't read but might be worthwhile reading is by Julie Norum, and it's called The Positive Power of Negative Thinking. Thank you.
Yeah, I think thanks so much for those remarks. But, you know, I think Trump is a great example of someone who's afraid, you know, like he can't see an error, he can't make an error, whatever he thinks has got to be right, and, you know, that's the most important.
Yeah. You brought up bullying and said that they have great self-esteem. And I found that bullies do not.
Mm-hmm.
And but in general, bullies pull a lot of people around them because they're afraid, and everybody supports the bullies because they're afraid of these bullies themselves. So I disagree with the idea that bullies have self-esteem. And if you can break that down, the bullies, and with teenagers, when I found the bullies, I would call them sweethearts and, hey, come here, honey. And it would just reduce the whole thing. And then all the kids around them thought that was funny. And that would break down the bully to that. And I think that's what Trump is a bully. And you still have these people around him. And if somebody
says, I don't believe that Trump has those up.
No,
and they actually, I mean, intuitively, it doesn't seem like bullies have low self-esteem, but the studies actually show that we don't report even that they
have. They self-esteem and self-confidence.
Yeah,
I think it would. But they'd be self-confident, but still have self-doubt.
That's true. Right. Yeah, that's true.
They could have self-esteem, they could think they're pretty cool, but still not know what to do next. You know, so.
There's
a big religious component slash magical thinking kind of thing that goes along with positive thinking. You could call it the power of magical thinking.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I think just the point, I think I recall, first of all, radio programs and later TV programs in which Norman Vincent Peale, whose real title was the Reverend Doctor Norman Vincent Peale, and he was a pastor of some big church in New York City.
That was a church.
No.
And they're reassembled. according to grammatical rules, they're essentially at random. So you have this word salad that sounds incredibly profound, and yet it's completely meaningless. And there's a little text you can say on another page on the front, when it shows you one, and you don't determine whether he actually said it, or whether it was synthesized.
Well, be careful, because that's anti-Gingrich analytical marketing,
that's dumb. It's amusing, if you read this very powerful and seemingly deep aphorisms that come out of it, and it could just be a word salad of random stuff that you I think it's the wisdom of Chaucer.com.
Yeah. Another area where quantum thinking might be a problem is the so-called prosperity doctrine.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was probably some of these books that church is so after all, being charitable, you know, God loves you as long as you be rich, and the richer you are, the more God loves you. So, that's definitely happening, yeah. There's another tidbit from Aaron Wright's book that I might mention, because I think it's relevant to today. And she said, and there's something to the effect that this is, you relentless optimism to control citizenry. And I think that's relevant to the authoritarian movement that we see not only in the US but around the world.
And especially in Russia now.
Yes.
Having been there, I was amazed at the support of Putin. Because they all believe that, you know, we've got to bring them all prosperity and whatnot, regardless of it, authoritarian.
And I regard you as religion also. Let me use as religion also. That was the basis of World War II.
Or is it nature?
Well, I don't know if any of you, I'm a pessimist, but I'm a Catalan too. And so there's a lot of situations I put myself into. And I said, well, some people died doing it, but 6,000 people survived doing it. So, you know, it's a throw of the dice, and who knows, you know, what will happen. But there's a swing between pessimism and optimism that can be integrated. And you succeed. Or I don't think
I don't know if that's optimism, but if you look at it realistically, know the odds and decide it's worth it anyway, that's a different thing from denying that anything could go wrong.
So there's things that go wrong. And a lot of people are just
denying that things could go wrong is optimism, but thinking it's worth it anyway, I understand the risk that it's worth it.
Yeah, because so many people did, their ears on scale of this and that. As I get older, I think I'm less trepidatious than I'm used to it. But I'm challenged that kind of thing. But the other thing that you brought up was interesting about technology. And it's easy to start a project in a big corporation like IBM, but it takes years to kill the project.
Yeah, because I had several situations where I would go to my boss and say, we're starting to fall behind, we need to go and tell somebody, can't tell anybody, do the best you can.
Did you just need to get more
clear
as you get older?
And I challenge myself. If I'm standing on the top of a long ski run that's with the black line.
But I thought I would say, less trepidation.
Yeah.
Did you mean that? Do you find the risk less frightening now than you did, say, 20 years ago?
Maybe so. Maybe eight. How much longer?
is that your feeling, that as you get older, you get less careful?
I think I'm more confident as I get older. About.
Can you give me an answer to this?
It depends when I'm there. Right. Am I going to jump or not?
I mean, that's more like experience as you get older.
Yeah.
You need to have a larger base to draw from for the situation. I think most of us do. We're more reckless than the others.
As a matter of my career, not in the capitalist system, but take money out of it. Optimism is something we use as a managerial tool to bring everybody together on the same page to achieve something that is worthwhile in the world. I've always run cause-oriented organizations, nonprofit. Money was not an issue, so people aren't cutting each other's throats. I never worked in the corporate world, but I do believe in optimism when it comes to solving issues in the world.
I think you're saying, as you can, you need to deal with it. You're so focused on the goal that even though you're seeing all these indications that you're not going to make
but
it,
what causes
you cannot let go of it.
But what causes the stress from that? My boss wants me to do
exactly.
So the company will make money.
Yeah.
But if you're not in that situation, and it's a joyful.
Uh-huh.
Right? Well, I'm not spiritual. I believe in organizational development.
Yeah.
I think it's very good.
But some things stay all the time about it.
Documents. Why? Because of his malignant narcissism, his solipsistic view of reality, and so on. He is such a danger, not just to the U.S., but to the entire world.
Have any of them actually ever interviewed you?
No, and that's a deficiency. He was sure he had to admit. But he had to be in the middle of a law.
I mean, I'm sorry. I don't want to argue with anybody, but I think a doctor should actually interview someone.
Oh, yes, of course. Right, and that's a principle of the American Psychiatric Association, which some have accused the authors of this.
I'm not at all. I'm just saying that I think before, however many doctors it was, that he quoted should say anything, they probably should.
Well, that's the main criticism of his book.
Yeah.
It's something Roel Johnson wrote, what is it? Where psychologists are not supposed to make diagnosis. Something Roel. I've got the name of it. Where psychologists are not allowed to make diagnosis.
And these authors explain why they have felt that the need to alert people to the dangerousness, confidence overrider. The point I want to make, however, is that although nobody has examined Trump personally, he has a long, enormous public record of statements that he has made, of views of reality that he has expressed, and so on. So if they're not diagnosing him, well, they're not trying to diagnose him. But they're not, it's not like it was in the vat, you know.
I'll let you use that, but I take offense, and I'm sorry, you, but I take offense at quoting a doctor saying something about him when he had an interview. I don't think you would let a doctor in Russia say you have a disease when they haven't even seen you before.
But we've seen you, though.
Mom, our friend, got on the phone with his cell phone.
hysterical, very upset. I immediately wondered what the hell was going on. But I got to speak to this fellow, an attorney, young man, 35. I was always surprised that he even got this job. I don't know what. I was very surprised. Whatever. And I tried to ask as nicely as I could, because I don't want to have to say things that I think he might be free to say, but you know, pretty quick. And I said, look what we're seeing here. What's going on? I mean, is this real? Is it written? Is this just, where does this come from? And what I tell you is, he said, this is him. This, what you see, that's him. That's how he even said that. That's how he is. I don't know what the rest, but that's what he said. It just didn't bode well. I mean, you know, I had people who worked for the beforehand, and they had independent contractors. Never nice words. Their money would take years to come, 30 cents on a dollar. At the time, they had no more money to buy it. They just couldn't.
I want to interject a comment, not for any other reason than the fact that we need to get away from discussion after what Trump or anything else. I'm not saying that I will be silly, but we need to get back on the topic again. And I think that I heard what her presentation was, and I'm going to think about the terms of positive thinking. Clearly, that's why I'm here.
Yes.
But at the same time, my immediate reaction is that as a big picture group, positive thinking is not a bad thing at all. But it has to have a dose of reality.
Yes.
You can't just think positively just because somebody says so, one way or the other. That anything that you do towards all is ultimately only bad, like drinking 20 glasses of water.
It's unrealistic.
I want to get at least to my perspective. You want to put some realism into your thinking. Change your expectation as you go along. And have a dose of optimism, but also back off. When you know that it's unrealistic. But it can be worse or whatever it is. So I would think that the positive thinking is perilous unless you stop using your brain cells.
What we need is the power of rationalism.
And obviously that's the other extreme, right? And obviously that is not good. There needs to be a balance.
And you have something, and this is what you learn,
and you apply it. So we move that into the other.
Yeah, you did well. Now, whether they come out of the visualized
people, I think that they're so maybe it's okay to visualize the accomplishment and visualize yourself taking the steps to accomplish what's the next step.
In my
lifetime, on a national level, I've observed three common visions for people. One was ending the Second World War. The second was me going to the moon. And the third was the bicentennial commemoration. And I was personally involved in that in Washington, D.C., where millions and millions and millions of people came together because they shared a common interest. And that's the solution to what we don't have now. Now we have fractured polarization. So where does the common vision for what the country can be come?
I think an analogy is the Olympics. The Olympics always brings everybody together and it's a big international, and you will, regardless of your American, you're rooting for this other person from where you know, Norway or whatnot, who's better.
Well, that's the point, but at the global level.
That's a global level.
Uh-huh. So. Well, what I'd like to learn here is that I just heard two comments from other people that positive thinking breeds selfishness, meaning I, and focuses on your own. Each other. And I don't understand that because I think their positive thinking is not necessarily not having empathy for other people. Positive thinking to me, and I could be with you talk on that, is essentially having a view of the world, okay? Mm-hmm. That is a positive way of thinking. That's all I'm talking about. That's what I'm taking from what thinking. In other words, if you think of an event, you think that it's going to work as opposed to not going to work without even initiating that. That to me is negative thinking. Without initiating, you say it's not going to work. And of course, in the other side of that is that if you say it's going to work without having any unrealistic expectations, then that's also equally bad. I understand that side. But I think that on a large, in a big picture basis, positive thinking that I think is probably part of the result of maybe some DNA, but also life experiences. Because I'm thinking if you have a positive experience, then you don't think that things are going to work.
That's an opposite correlation.
Yeah.
If you live a long, happy life,
you're probably going to be
more optimistic.
Okay. But all what I'm saying essentially is that I don't see where the selfishness is
kicking
in.
Oh, but it was right at the beginning. Norman Vincent Peale, think about others, gather sunshine, yeah. Brian Tracy, think about what you want and how to get it. And I'm talking about positive thinking taken to the extreme. I'm talking about taken to an ideology, taken to the extreme. And that's what we think about that too.
Right. In the minds of the right people, it becomes opportunism so that you have a goal. I think there's many ways to polarize, but if you're that's where you're going, then any opportunity that pops up, to grab it.
Yeah, and I hope nobody thinks I wasn't about that. And if you go look at who was it, Edison, inventing the light bulb.
That's right. That's
and how many failures he had. And they said, you failed 10,000 times, how do you feel about that? He said, no, it could be 10,000 steps to succeed. So he was able to roll each of the failures and understand that doesn't mean I can't do it. That just means I learned something. And
but
I
if you go next. With what this person was saying right here, mm-hmm. If your goal is to, how do you say it, better the world, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess deep down I'm a missionary, even though I don't believe in religion. But if your goal, if that's what you think you're about on the earth, and that's what you think evolution is about, all people evolving to make a better world, then you're going to look, you need to go, and you're going to look for opportunities for them.
Yeah, I understand. Nobody can say positive, right? It's just winning.
People coming from the corporate world.
Yeah, it's just winning.
I want to mention that the other side of the spectrum, this kind of toxic pessimism that I've seen from the religious. You know, I see this on the internet a lot. People who describe we live in a in a base matter universe fit for apocalyptic destruction, where spirits trapped in this vile flesh body, humanity is a sick, earthly disease race. We should stay uninvolved with this horrible world out there. This kind of thing, and the other side, that's gotta be destructive. Have you seen that before, any of you? I've actually a lot.
Where you're taking faster, it makes it keep that time. So I don't see what you know, how would that? I'll put it up that way.
Because you're going to have negative thoughts. You cannot just push them away. That's not how you would be
from the
together. So you need to have strategies for learning to deal with them rather than trying to deny them.
That would be great.
And that's what I'm trying to do. You need to have strategies. When I'm trying to parallel positive, I'm saying positive is bad. I'm thinking so you can recognize when you're going off the rails. When it's starting to become a negative thing or a destructive thing rather than thinking where you want to go. And negative thing, you can take it where you want to go too. Of examining the populations and go along with planning for them.
When it is planning, positive thinking becomes a religion, like the unity term, which my parents joined 50 years ago and really destroyed the family because there was no conversation. My mother would always say, think positive. And that was it. So it denied the reality of what was happening in our life. Just think positive. And unity really, to me, is very destructive with that because it disallows the reality of what's happening and the ability to convert.
And is there any assessment?
No.
I mean, assessment is part of it.
Yes, but you need to
go to assess.
I'm talking about a religion. Yeah.
Oh,
and I saw the signs of a religion.
Sure.
Everything is for the best.
And there is somebody here who said to me, I made a remark, and she said, you know what the Dalai Lama does every day? He takes a deep breath, and then he blows out all the negativism. So I wanted to tell her about the Nepalese the Dalai Lama, because he left them in Nepal. And he lived a very luxurious life. It was so that the breath that he probably throws out blows out in the morning.
But I say, break up into our conversation. The next meeting, this will be helping to learn how to trust again.
Did you say that again last year?
So the next meeting is going to be, how do I learn to trust again? How do I know what is real, what is real? I have no idea. Thank you all. And if anyone wants to present anything,
any future
speakers? Yes, anybody?